Actor and comedian Jamie Foxx talks about the time he was doing stand-up, and he got to the point in his routine where he does his Mike Tyson impersonation, and he says it always brings a standing ovation. And if you've ever heard it, you understand why. It's spot on. And so he gets to this point, and he does his Mike Tyson impersonation, and when he finished, nobody laughs. And of course, he's confused, but then after a little bit of silence, somebody yells out, "Mike is in here." Mike Tyson was in the building as he's telling this joke, and he had no idea what to do. And so Jamie Foxx puts it this way. He says that Mike Tyson was knocking people out for just smiling at the time. You know, this is when Mike's at his most unstable point. And so he was legitimately scared, and he kind of stopped short because nobody was laughing. So he didn't finish his impersonation completely. He didn't completely do it. In fact, I think he just led into it. So he just said he was going to do this bit, and everybody was silent. And so he was scared at that point to continue. The guy shouts out, the guy that had shouted out before, he said that Mike said, "Do the joke, but make sure it's funny." So then he does proceed. And people do laugh at that point. They laugh. They give him a standing ovation. You know, it's a funny joke. Something about Mike Tyson ordering slaw to drive through. And so in order to do that well, you have to accentuate his lisp, the way that he speaks. So joke goes over well again. And after the show, Mike Tyson walks up to him. Nothing crazy happens, though. He actually invites Jamie Foxx to join him in his limo afterwards and go around town with him and party with him. But at that point, Foxx says that he was basically his jester. And so Mike Tyson at some point would say, "Make me laugh." And he would just try to make him laugh as best he could because he was scared out of his mind that he's standing there before Iron Mike, who's this king of knockouts. So when he's doing his stand-up, he's not thinking Mike's around. He's fairly disrespectful. But then when he's in Mike Tyson's presence, he says whatever Mike Tyson wants him to say. I think that's the way we often are with important people, powerful people. If we don't think that they're around on a certain way with them, but if we're actually in their presence, that's when we're going to be respectful. So the reality is we have a problem in not realizing whose presence we're in all the time. One of the biggest problems everyone really has is not realizing that God is present. He's in the room. Second but equal problem with that is we don't recognize that he's holy. And God's holiness is much more intimidating than an uppercut that could floor you. So when you realize what God's holiness means, it's going to change everything. Knowledge of God's holy presence, it should transform your life. By his grace, it should cause us to live with that faith, hope, and love that we're called to. So in chapter 6, Isaiah told us about this vision he had of God on in his throne room, in the temple, but also in heaven. And there are these seraphim, fiery seraphim flying around the top. And the glory of God is filling the temple completely. And that wasn't just this neat thing that happened to Isaiah. It transformed the way that he lived. In fact, Isaiah from then on calls God the Holy One. That's what he thought when he thought about God. And it was in that year of the king's decline, the human king Uzziah's decline and eventual death, that Isaiah had seen another king on another throne. A higher throne, a higher king, and that was the one that he was supposed to pay attention to. And that was Israel's problem. They weren't paying attention to this God. They weren't recognizing his holy presence that was dwelling with them in the temple. And they're not alone. Many of us fail to recognize this holy God that is in the building. He's in here. So how would our lives change if we knew that? how would our approach to life change? This morning, we're going to hear from God himself about how his holy presence should impact us. So in Isaiah 8, in verses 1 through 15, that's where we're going to be. You can turn there. In these verses, we're going to be encouraged with three certainties because a holy God is with us. Because God is holy and because he is with us, we can be sure that he is sovereign over everything that happens in our world. And we can be certain that our salvation must come through judgment. And we can also be sure that we must fear this holy God. Now, that's the kicker, right? The fear of God. That's the one that we don't really get or necessarily like. You don't hear about that in popular Christianity. But as we've gone through the Bible, it's come up a lot. We've heard it mentioned numerous times. And yes, we've heard it mentioned in the Old Testament, for sure. But we've also heard about it mentioned in the New Testament. Jesus mentions the fear of God in Matthew. Peter mentions it in his first epistle. Paul mentions it in Philippians. And I'm just talking about the ones that I've covered since I've been here. So this idea is very common in the Bible, but not very common in Christian descriptions of God. And one of the reasons for that is we don't really have a clear understanding of what the holiness of God is. And that's something that Isaiah is at pains to show us in his prophecy. If we were to listen to popular forms of Christianity, based on what people talk about or what they post on Facebook or what have you, it doesn't seem to have a lot to do with God's holiness. It seems to have a lot to do with us. So if you listen to how people talk, you'd say that God exists. He's in the world, but he's not really an everyday part of your life. You know, he's there if you need him. And he wants us to do what's good, but he's not too uptight about that. Good people are going to go to heaven in general. And often, organized religion gets in the way. I mean, we don't need a pastor or a church to tell us what God is like. We pretty much know. That's the conception that's out there. But I want you to imagine something. I want you to imagine that somebody was talking to you, and you'd never met this person before. And they were telling you what you were like. They didn't know you. They've had no interactions with you, and yet they were telling you what you were like. What how would that make you feel? You think they'd get you right? How do we know what God is like? He has to actually tell us, reveal himself to us. And that's what the Bible claims to do. It claims to tell us what God is like. And it does not describe the popular God of our day. It describes a God who is holy. A holy God who has made himself known by his prophets and chiefly, supremely by his Son. So we want to listen to what God says about himself. And he tells us here that he is a holy God who is with us. And because of that, there are three realities that we can be certain of. And the first is this: God's holy presence assures us that he is sovereign. He's in charge. Johnny Carson did this bit called Karnak the Magnificent. Somebody remember that? Karnak is this mystic from the East, and he could divine answers to questions that he had never seen before. And so Ed McMahon, Carson's sidekick, he'd introduce it this way. He'd said, "I hold in my hand the envelopes. As a child of four can plainly see, these envelopes have been hermetically sealed. They've been kept in a mayonnaise jar on Funk and Wagnall's porch since noon today. No one knows the contents of these envelopes. But you," pointing to Johnny Carson, "in your mystical and borderline divine way, will ascertain the answers, having never before heard the questions." And so he takes these sealed envelopes, and he holds one of them to his head, and he gives an answer to the question that's inside, or to the statement that's inside. And so he'd take one, and he'd hold it to his head, and he'd say, "Gatorade." And then Ed McMahon would say, "Gatorade." And he'd tear open and pull it out, and he would say, What does an alligator get on welfare? That's what he's saying. He's answered the question without ever looking at the question. Or he'd say, sis boom ba. And then he would open it up and say, describe the sound made when a sheep explodes. And it's all corny. It's a joke. But this concept of divining things, that is the kind of basic concept. I mean, he's using it as a comedic bit, but that's kind of this word that we use. When you use divine as a noun, it refers to God. When you use divine as a verb, you're talking about being able to have access to some knowledge that's hidden normally. So you think of it in terms of the future. People divine the future. That's what we imagine. We're, God is just somehow able to do that. So that's the misconception we have about God. We kind of think he's like Karnak. We think he can divine the future, that he's just good at prediction. He can just look into the future and he can tell us what's going to happen before it happens. God really does know the future, but not simply because he can look into the future. God knows the future because he's in charge of it. So he's not, he's holy. That does mean he's not limited by time. He's not limited by the things that limit this creation. So he's not limited by time, but he's also not limited by power or authority. And so he's sovereign. He can tell the future because he's in charge of it. So the Lord tells Isaiah this. He says, basically he's erecting a billboard. He says, take a large tablet and write on it in common letters. Other translations say it's a large scroll. We don't know what the surface really was, but it's some object big enough for people to read as they pass by. And it's written in this clear manner, a manner any common person can read. And what does he write? Well, the ESV, just like most translations do, they just transliterate these Hebrew words. They just put English letters to the Hebrew letters and spell out this, what's four words in Hebrew, they hyphenate into kind of one big word. Maher Shalal Hash Baz. So at this point that we're reading, it's not clearly a name. Names weren't generally that long. But it's kind of a statement. I think John Oswalt makes the best sense out of it. He translates it, speeding to the plunder, hurrying to the spoil. So you can see there's a repetition there. There's just saying both statements twice in just different ways, speeding and hurrying, plunder and spoil. And just like we would experience in hearing those words, you don't know exactly what he's saying, but it does sound ominous. And so the Lord then tells him to write this, but also tells him that he needs reliable witnesses in verse 2. So he wants Uriah the priest and Zechariah the son of Jeberechiah to attest, to be witnesses that Isaiah has done this for the Lord. And what they're trying to bear witness to, what they're giving a witness to, is when this was written. The Lord wants everybody to know that he wrote this before these events happen. And then after that, Isaiah has a son with his wife. She's referred to as the prophetess. That could be because she had a role like Isaiah. She was a mouthpiece for the Lord. It could also be that because she's naming her children this, she's naming these children prophetic names, Shair Sha'ar Yeshuv and Mahar Shalal Hashbaz. These are great names if you are thinking about baby names. But they're prophetic. They're names that speak something. And so in that sense, she might be a prophetess. And so regardless, God tells us the significance of this name. He says in verse 4 that this name is because before the boy knows how to cry, my father or my mother, the wealth of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria will be carried away before the king of Assyria. The Lord is saying is that before this little baby boy is able to speak these words, and these are very simple words in Hebrew, Avi, my father, Imi, my mother. Before he's able to speak these words, the wealth of these nations' capitals, Damascus in Syria, Samaria in Israel, they were going to be carried away. They were going to be plundered. They were going to be spoiled, and they would be placed then before the king of Assyria. Now, God's telling them before it happens that this is going to be the case. Telling them what these words mean. Why does he do that? Well, he tells us later on in Isaiah. He says that he wants us to know this about him. In chapter 46, I am God and there is no other. I am God and there's none like me, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times things not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand and I will accomplish my purposes, all my purpose. I have spoken and I will bring it to pass. I have purposed and I will do it. So God's not some two-bit Karnak just telling us things, prognosticating. He's telling us the future because that's what he's going to do. He's in charge of it. So this name wasn't just a testimony to some amazing ability that God has to see into the future. It was testifying to the fact that God is in charge. He is sovereign. When this happens, you will know that he's sovereign. See, this testified to God's holiness. Even the ancients understood that the gods were holy. They just didn't understand what that really meant. That meant this is what it means to be God. This is what it means to be holy. He is the uncreated one. He's not limited by the powers and authorities in this world. He's the Holy One, the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords. And he's the God of any spiritual being that would try to say that it's a God. He's in charge of all these forces. Just like he says here by referring to himself as the Lord of hosts. There is not a single force in this universe that's outside of his control. So he's not a God of parlor tricks. He's not just trying to impress us with his abilities. He's revealing who he is so that we don't act like a bunch of arrogant fools and try to tell him what he's like. He's telling us what he's like. He wants us to know him. This is very important that we know this about him. So is this the God that you know? Is this the God that you realize, this holy God? He doesn't just know what's going to happen. He has planned for it. For his good, for you, and all for his glory. Is that the God who's in the building? Is that the God who's with you? Is he there when you're going through extremely difficult times? Is that the God who's there? Is that the God who's there when you're experiencing a tragedy? Is it the God who's there when your family is in turmoil? Is it the God who's there when your whole world gets turned upside down? Is that the God who's with you? He's the Holy One. He is sovereign over everything that happens. He may not, and he often does not, give you any indication of why he's doing what he's doing. But he does want you to know who he is. He wants you to know that you can trust him. You can trust this holy God. He is sovereign. He is in charge. Things look like chaos, but it's not chaos. What else can we be certain of with this holy God who is with us? Second, God's holy presence assures us that salvation is through judgment. My pastor down in Louisville and a friend, Jim Hamilton, he has a book that comprehensively takes that theme and traces it throughout the Bible. His book is called God's Glory and Salvation Through Judgment. And it is this extensive theme. You do find it throughout the Bible. I've mentioned it numerous times. And there's a reason why I then took, and I didn't bring it up here, but the bulletin. My subtitle for the book of Isaiah is The Holy King's Salvation Through Judgment. That's what Isaiah is all about. But that isn't what people usually think when it comes to salvation. So here's the misconception that we have about God. We think that since God's loving, he saves us from our sin instead of judging our sin. And you say, well, that kind of sounds right, but it's not quite right. It's true, God is loving, and he does save us from our sin. He does save us from the judgment that we deserve, but he still judges that sin. He still punishes that sin. It's very important for us to understand who God is and that's the case. That's why the Lord Jesus died on the cross. God was judging the sin of everyone who turns to Christ when Jesus was on the cross. So, When the Lord speaks to Isaiah in verse 5 here, he's talking about judgment. And this is a necessary reality. And so verse 6 talks about the sin. It says that his people have refused the waters of Shiloah that flow gently and rejoice over Rezin and the son of Remaliah. What are the waters of Shiloah? When Ken and I were in Israel, we visited the site of the pool of Siloam. That's a gray-sized word. You know, it's like taking the Hebrew and making it into Greek and then translating it into English. And that's how we get to Siloam. But that's referring to the same idea. In fact, in the sign there in Hebrew says Shiloah. That's what this word is. So the pool of Siloam wasn't there in Ahaz's day and Isaiah's day. That was constructed later, and it was the spring. This is referring to the spring that ended up being diverted by Hezekiah into this pool of Siloam. But the spring was there, and so that's what it's referring to. And this spring of Shiloah, it's this really trickling little spring. It's not this abundant water supply. It was consistent, but it was not an impressive water supply. It just flows gently. That's how Isaiah puts it. And as John McKay puts it, this seemingly pathetic trickle emphasized the vulnerability of the city to siege and how reliant it was on divine protection. So God placed Israel in this vulnerable setting, but Israel didn't want to be vulnerable. They didn't want this kind of protection. They didn't want to depend on God in this trickling little gentle spring. And so they wanted some real water, some real provision. And so God's provision for them, it's compared to this gently flowing waters of Shiloah. Then we see the waters of Syria. That's the provision that Israel saw in Assyria. It was like the mighty rushing waters of the Euphrates River. And just as that rushing water came into Israel and Syria, and it rushed over those nations. It destroyed them, and as it did, Judah rejoiced. They were so happy. They thought they'd put their eggs in the right basket. They thought they had set themselves up well, depended on the right person. But because they'd rejected God's provision and took on and went to Assyria, the Lord can't even refer to them as his people. He calls them here this people. And he says in verses 7 and 8, "Therefore, behold, the Lord is bringing up against them the waters of the river, mighty and many, the king of Assyria and all his glory, and it will rise over all its channels and over all its banks, and it will sweep on into Judah. It will overflow and pass on, reaching even up to the neck, and its outspread wings will fill the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel." So again, you have this consistent thing in prophets, this word behold, followed by a participle. He's saying, this is what I'm about to do. This is about to happen. He mentions the river. You didn't have to refer to the Euphrates. You could just say the river. Everybody knew what you were talking about. And then he describes this metaphor. He tells us exactly what he means. He means the king of Assyria and all his glory, all that goes with the king, all his power, all his armies. So the people of Judah, they're rejoicing over what had just happened north of them. This rushing wave of an army came over the north to Syria and Israel. And they were rejoicing in that, but it wasn't going to stop. Those waters weren't going to stop up north. They were going to keep rushing down south. And they were going to keep attacking, trying to drown Judah, trying to conquer them. And that was all because the people had trusted in Assyria. Since they had trusted in Assyria, the Lord gave them Assyria. Assyria wanted to take over Judah. That's what Assyria wanted. Israel thought, oh, we can trust them. They're going to take care of us. They wanted to take over everything. And so they would keep coming. But the Lord does give us some hope in this passage. He gives his people hope because they wouldn't be completely drowned. They wouldn't be completely taken over. They'd reach, the waters would rush in and reach this really nearly unbearable point, the neck of the people. Like the waters are coming in and it seems like they're going to get overwhelmed, but it stops just short of the top of their head. And then the Lord describes it, Assyria, as this bird of prey, and its wings are so large it covers the whole land. And he then draws attention to this little boy that he just prophesied about in chapter 7, this Emmanuel. This was a sign to Ahaz that, one, God was with them, so that there was hope. But even in chapter 7, verse 17 and verses 18 and following, it's very clear it's not a completely good sign for Israel, because this boy is going to eat curds and honey. And the reason why he's going to do that is because this land is going to be completely decimated, and there's just going to be a few people left. And so that's what you see here. Judah is going to be decimated. They wouldn't escape Assyria, but they wouldn't be completely destroyed. And it's at this point that God says, not only are they not destroyed, but he mentions Emmanuel, and you could just translate that. It's just Hebrew for God with us. And so he's reminding them of this revelation that God is with us. God is with his people. And what that then meant is that God shifts. And now he's not talking to Israel, or he's not talking to Judah. Now he turns to talk to Assyria. And that's what you see in verses 9 and 10. And I think the first part of what he says to Assyria is probably better translated something like be in uproar or band together, given the parallels. So following the CSB, it says, band together, peoples, and be broken. Pay attention, all you distant lands. Prepare for war and be broken. Prepare for war and be broken. He's saying, just try to conquer them. Just try to completely take over them. It's not going to work. And then we saw in chapter 46 that God's counsels stand. What he proposed, what he purposes is going to happen, but that's not true for Assyria. And so he says, take counsel together, but it will come to nothing. Speak a word, but it will not stand. God's counsel will stand. Theirs will not. Their plans will fail. Why? For God is with us. So God's holy presence is there. And what that means in these verses is, one, that God must punish his people's sin. But it also means that God will save his people. So I want you just to imagine a judge hearing a case. And we'll say this is the judge that determines the verdict here. And so he's in this courtroom, and he's hearing a case of a person who they've vandalized some property. Maybe they sprayed something all over somebody's garage. And so the judge hears the case, and the evidence is very clear. Beyond reasonable doubt, this is obvious that this person is guilty of this crime. And just imagine that this judge says, okay, you deserve to pay for these damages, but I'm a loving judge, and you're free to go. You might think the judge is loving to the person, the criminal that just walked out, but you wouldn't say that's justice, would you? And you wouldn't really say that was loving to the person who'd been vandalized. And so here's the reality about God's justice and about his love. He is both loving and just. He is both loving and righteous. And the more we understand his holiness, the more we realize the significance of our sin. Our sin is like vandalism. It's like vandalism to God's holiness. It's like vandalism to God's creation. And it calls for a payment to be made to make it right. And God as a judge is not making things right by simply saying, you don't have to pay for that. Nobody has to pay for that. There is a payment that needs to be made. And so when we understand that God is holy, we understand what that means. That means, on the one hand, he is loving. On the other hand, he's righteous. It means that because he is righteous, our sin must be punished. But because he's loving, he can rescue us. But that salvation only comes through the just judgment of that sin. And again, that's why Jesus came and died. Jesus had nothing to pay for. He had no sin. He had done nothing wrong. There was no vandalism, no destruction of property. Nothing had been done by Jesus that he had to pay for. And because he is God the Son, he is divine, he is able to pay for anyone and everyone who trusts in him. He can pay for their damages. In fact, he has paid for their damages. Everyone who comes to him, everyone who recognizes their sin, he paid for those damages. So the damages are paid for, and the person is saved. That's what a holy God does. That's what Jesus has done. And so that's what we want everybody to know. We want them to understand the cross. We want them to understand why Jesus died. He died to save sinners who turn from their sin and trust in him. And that death was necessary. That's why we call people to turn to him and trust in him. Trust in him because that's what he's accomplished. That's what we say to you. We would say to anybody here, trust in Jesus and what he's done. You can be certain that if you trust in Jesus, you will be saved. What else can we be certain of with this holy God who's with us? God's holy presence assures us that we must fear him. So if you think about, what does it look like to trust in Jesus? Well, you would be right in saying that that means you believe in Jesus. You believe that he died to save you by his death. And you love him for that. But it also means that you need to believe who Jesus is and who he said he is. He is the Christ, the Son of the living God. So he is the King over all. He is the Holy Divine Son. And you must believe that about him. And that changes everything. So again, there's another misconception we have about God. We can easily think that God is important, but he's not everything in your life. You know, don't get crazy. Don't think you have to become some super spiritual religious person. God, again, he just make sure you go to church when you can. Make sure that you put some nice things around your house from Hobby Lobby that say, hey, this house is for God. Make sure that's up there. Don't do anything crazy. Just be a generally good person. And God will be happy with that. That's enough. But this God that you have a relationship with through Jesus is holy. And the Father, the Son, and Spirit, they're holy. So what that means is he's not just one part of your life, that he is your life. Holiness is this all-encompassing reality. In fact, holiness is the basis for reality. Because God is holy, it means that he's distinct from his creation. What does that mean? That means that he's independent of it, that he's not relying on creation in any way. In fact, creation is relying on him. All of creation, everything relies on him. Every breath that you breathe, every second you're alive is dependent on God. That's what holiness means. That's what it means to have a holy God in the biblical sense. And that kind of a holy God requires an all-encompassing response. If you have a relationship with a holy God, it means that you need to acknowledge his holiness in every area of your life. And that was extremely important for Isaiah to understand and to convey. And that's why he mentions here, when he says that the Lord spoke to him, he adds, with a strong hand upon me. This is important. He says it came with a stern warning not to walk in the way of his people. Judah has done the exact wrong thing when it comes to being with the holy God and responding to a holy God. And he's telling him, don't do that. Don't follow their example. So what was the problem? It had to do with what they regarded as most significant in their lives. So you saw it in their political responses. The Lord tells Isaiah in verse 12, do not call conspiracy all that this people calls conspiracy, and do not fear what they fear, nor be in dread. The term conspiracy is not, it's not the clearest of terms. It's not a common term. It usually has something to do with treason or some plotting. So there's some hidden quality to it. And you see plotting with Syria and Israel, and you probably heard people in Judah saying, oh, there's some plotting going on in Assyria. And there was fear going on about what was going on behind the scenes. That seems to be the stress here of this idea. Things are happening that are out of your control. Things are happening that are in the background, behind the scenes. And so the Lord was telling Isaiah and his faithful followers, the verbs and everything here are plural now. He's telling them, you should not look at the world the way that the people around you do. You should not be afraid of what they're afraid of. We hear a lot of plotting going on in our world. We have a lot of people that are telling us they know what's going on behind the scenes, and they tell us about it. But really, that just is fear-mongering. It's just, in terms of what it amounts to, it's just trying to induce fear. Because whether this is an angry mob that you know about or some subversive ruling class or some ruling class behind the scenes, whatever it is, there's nothing that you can do about them. And so what it does is it stirs up fear. You believe this is happening. There's nothing we can do about this mob. There's nothing we can do about this secret ruling class of people. It just produces fear, and that then leads to other responses. And so the Lord tells his people, that's not how you look at the world. That's not the way you think about the world. We're not at the mercy of any mob or any secret ruling class. Because there's a holy God on his throne. So Christians can never look at the world that way. We can't look at these mobs and think, what are we going to do? We can't look at look at things going on behind the scenes. What are we going to do about that? No, that is exactly what Judah was doing, and they were wrong. We don't look at that this way. We don't look at the world this way. You know, when you're dealing with things, you deal with the knowns. You shouldn't be sitting at home doing some type of research on conspiratorial groups or researching groups that you can't do anything about to stop. You do want to pay attention to philosophies and address philosophies. You want to address views and political issues that come up. You want to think through them. But worrying about people that are pulling the strings is not what you should do. It's not how you should spend your time. We don't fear what people in our society fear. What do we do? Verse 13 tells us what we do. But the Lord of hosts, him you shall honor as holy. Let him be your fear. Let him be your dread. You remember the no fear craze? People would say, no fear. That's not what the Bible calls us to. We're to fear the Lord. Why? That's what this verse and these verses go on to tell us about. It explains the other side of it. The flip side of fearing God is honoring him as holy. You treat God as though he's holy. You acknowledge that there's nothing in all creation that compares with this God. He's distinct from creation. So he's not like created things. He's not limited by things in this universe. He's an unlimited God. He transcends his creation. Every power that exists in the universe is nothing compared to him. All of it combined is nothing compared to this God. In fact, the way that he's described here is the Lord of hosts. This is the one who's in charge of all the powerful forces in the universe, the hosts. So you treat him that way. You treat him as the one who is in control. You don't treat him like the different powers and authorities in creation. God isn't like those powers. Earthly powers and authorities can be defeated. God cannot be defeated. Earthly forces can fail to achieve their purposes and plans. God's plans will succeed. The psalmist puts it this way: our God is in the heavens. He does all that he pleases. Everything that God wants, he does. No one can stop him from doing what he wants. He's not a merely created entity. He's not mortal. He is holy. And so we treat him that way. And that involves living in the fear of the Lord. Not in the fear of man. Not with no fear. We replace the fear that we could have in anything else or of anything else. We replace that with the fear of the Lord. Now, the Bible teaches in the Old Testament that fear coincides with our love for God. That's not a contradiction. It's like you could say, well, I can't love God because I have to fear him. No. Deuteronomy 10:12 says, and now, Israel, what does the Lord your God require of you but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, to love him? And this fear of the Lord doesn't lose sight of God's love for us. Again, Old Testament passage, Psalm 33:18. Behold, the eye of the Lord is on those who fear him, on those who hope in his steadfast love. Those aren't incongruent. So when you come to recognize who this God is, that in this God resides more power than any violent storm that exists, that in this God is more power than every nuclear armament that has ever existed or will ever exist. He is more more powerful than them combined. That he's more powerful than the sun or any star in the universe. That he's more powerful than any black hole in the universe. That he is this God who is supremely great. And yes, he is loving. He has demonstrated that in his son. But he is also righteous. And he does not cease to be what he is simply because he's chosen to have a relationship with you. He still hates sin. And his perfections are unsearchable. So he is not satisfied just with a good old college try. Oh, you just do your best. He'll be okay with it. Now recognize that this is the God who loved us enough because he wants us to reflect his holy character, to give his own son, to bring that about. He gave his son so that we would be like him. That was what he was willing to do. So what kind of a response ought we to have in light of this God? We ought to fear him. We fear him while we love him. We fear him even as we know he loves us. But if you have an actual understanding of God, as much as the fullest understanding that you can have, there is no possible way for you not to fear him. And you can't just kind of sweep that away by just referring to it as reverence. There's a legitimate intimidation in the presence of this God. That's the only rational response when you realize the truth of who he is. That we dwell with a holy God. And what he says here is that those who treat him with holiness, he will be a sanctuary for them. We hear that word, we often think in terms of, well, a sanctuary is a place that you can be rescued from, you can find refuge in. And you do see people in the Old Testament sometimes going to the temple, grabbing hold of the horns and saying, you know, you don't kill me. But the concept here is this holy place. That's the emphasis in the passage. That's what sanctuary means, holy place. This place in here is not holy. God's presence with us is holy. So this is what this is getting at, that God, for those that treat God as he is holy, he will be a holy place where they can dwell with him. Treat God as holy, he will be that holy place where you have fellowship with him. But if you don't treat God as holy, if you refuse to fear him, he says that he will be a stone of offense and a rock of stumbling. He says it's true for both houses of Israel, for all his people. His presence won't be a comfort, won't be a sanctuary. It'll offend them. It'll cause them to stumble. It'll be like a trap and a snare. They won't be able to escape from it. They'll stumble and fall and be broken. They'll be snared. They'll be taken. He's saying, for those who do not fear him, they will be judged. And the Old Covenant people experienced that through the exile. People that continued to just not fear God, not pay attention to his holiness, they faced that exile. But all of this is pointing to something more than that. All this was a picture that the New Testament explains is pointing to Jesus. And so when you see these verses quoted in the New Testament, it's kind of startling. Peter says that we honor God as holy by honoring Christ the Lord as holy. He says in 1 Peter 3, 14 through 15, quoting this passage, if anybody has any notions that the New Testament people didn't really think Jesus was God, Peter quotes this passage and applies it to Jesus. He says, have no fear of them, nor be troubled, but in your hearts honor Christ the Lord as holy. According to Isaiah, we honor the Lord of hosts as holy. Peter says, that's Jesus. You better treat him as holy. So when you come to Jesus for salvation, you're coming to Christ the Lord. You're coming to the Lord of hosts. You're coming to the holy God. And you must treat him as holy. And that does mean that your entire life revolves around him. And if it does not, you are not regarding him as holy. He's not just part of your life. He's not just that part of your life that you come on Sundays, I've dealt with God, and then I go and live my life. That is not treating Christ as holy. When you work, you do it to the Lord, for him. Whether you live or you die, you do everything to magnify Christ. That's what Paul teaches in Philippians. So Jesus really does redefine your life. He tells us, if you are going to be his disciple, you absolutely must deny yourself. If you are unwilling to deny yourself and follow him, Jesus says you're not worthy of him. That's not a subclass of Christians. That is the only people who are Christians, which, just a reminder, means little Christs. It's only the people that deny themselves because they recognize who Jesus is. He's the King. He's the Holy One. And he's the one who saved me, rescued me from my sin. And I'm going to give up what I'm holding on to follow him. By faith in him, you become part of his sanctuary. Spirit resides in you. That's the holy God residing in you in Christ. But if you do not regard Jesus as holy, he will be that stone of stumbling and rock of offense. That's what Peter says. He again quotes this passage in 1 Peter 2:8, and he says, it's Jesus. And he says, they stumble because they disobey the word. What is the word? It's the word about Christ. They do not obey the gospel. They do not repent and believe him who is the holy Lord. So do not fail to realize what God's holy presence in Christ means. It means that Christ is sovereign over your life. It means that your salvation must come through the judgment that fell on him. Now that salvation through his judgment comes to you by faith in him. And it means that we must fear him. Jesus is in the building. He's in here. And he is everywhere that you are. So how do you respond to that? Join me in prayer. Father, we recognize that we need your grace in this, and we are so thankful that you give us your spirit. You give us your spirit to transform our lives from one degree of glory to the next. But I pray that you'd help us, as this passage stresses, to take your holiness seriously. Jesus, I pray that we would take your holiness seriously. That though we have experienced this amazing love, that we would think of and remember, that we would also recognize you are righteous. And we'd recognize that you, Jesus, are the judge. You're the one who comes in the end. You're the one who rescues sinners through the judgment that fell on you. But those who do not turn, you are the one who declares that judgment. Help us to remember that you have not changed in this relationship we have with you. You have not ceased to hate sin. You gave up your life to rescue us from that. So keep us from being flippant about our sin. Keep us from quarantining you to this small place in our life. Convict our hearts of how we are not recognizing that you are our life. Through your spirit, convict our hearts. And spirit, anyone here who does not know you, who does not know the Son by means of you, and does not know the Father through the Son, that you would open their heart to pay attention to this good news about Jesus. Amen.